This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, listeners. Welcome to New Books and Celebration Studies, a special series on the New Books Network. I am Emily Allen, your host for this episode. Our guest is Dr. Cecile Fremon, editor of Afro-Catholic Festivals in the Americas, Performance, Representation, and the Making of Black Atlantic Tradition, published by Penn State University Press in 2019, and the paperback edition was just released in May of 2021. Afro-Catholic Festivals in the Americas demonstrates how, from the beginning of the Atlantic slave trade, enslaved and free Africans in the Americas used Catholicism and Christian-derived celebrations as spaces for autonomous cultural expression, social organization, and political empowerment. Their appropriation of Catholic-based celebrations calls into question the long-held idea that Africans and their descendants in the diaspora either resignedly accepted Christianity or else transformed its religious rituals into syncretic objects of stealthy resistance. In cities and on plantations throughout the Americas, men and women of African birth or descent staged mock battles against heathens, elected Christian queens and kings with great pageantry, and gathered in festive rituals to express their devotion to saints. The contributors to this volume draw connections between these Afro-Catholic festivals observed from North America to South America and the Caribbean, and their precedents in the early modern Kingdom of Congo, one of the main regions of origin of men and women enslaved in the New World. Our guest, Dr. Cecile Fremon, is Associate Professor of History of Art at Yale University. So welcome, Dr. Fremon.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be joining you today. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, looking forward to our talk. So before we actually dive into discussions of the book, can you tell our listeners more about yourself?
Yes, I am a professor in the History of Art department at Yale, and my writing and my teaching focuses in particular on Central Africa, so Congo and Angola, and then in conversation and in relation with Brazil. But more broadly, I teach and I research on African and Latin American visual and material culture, and as well on the Atlantic world and the emergence of the Black Atlantic from the early modern period on, so from 1500 to 1800, and focusing also on the long shadows that this era and these phenomena have cast on our own time.
Awesome. And I think that that definitely carries over into the scope of this book as well, of course, in terms of just the breadth of it and whatnot. So I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts on the book as well. And speaking of, you know, this text, you mentioned in the acknowledgments that this, you know, book actually kind of got started through a conference at Yale's Institute for Sacred Music. So can you tell us a little bit about the roots of this whole project?
Yes, thank you. So as I was a fellow at the Institute for Sacred Music, the Institute gave me the opportunity to put together a conference, a working day on a topic that I thought would be interesting to explore between scholars. And in my mind, I wanted to think more about the Congadas. So this particular type of festivals from Brazil that still exist today and during which Afro-Brazilian communities elect and celebrate a king and queen that represent their community and represent the sovereignty to some extent of their community within the larger Brazilian system. And so I was able, with the support of the ISM, to invite scholars from Brazil, from also around the United States. But what had already struck me then was the ways in which there seem to be real parallels, both historically and in the contemporary moments, between these congadas, who even, you know, that even in the name were obviously connected to the Congo and its historical past, which I had studied in my dissertation and my first book, and then other festivals really across the hemispheric Americas. So from north to south and in places that fell on either side of the linguistic, for example, a divide between English-speaking and Spanish-speaking or Brazilian or Portuguese-speaking Americas. And so I invited a range of people. And in our conversation during that one-day conference, we really explored that idea. And it really, you know, became clear to us that there was something really compelling in bringing together these different types of festivals. So New Orleans Carnival or Mexican early 16th century festivals that involved Afro-Mexican characters, for example, and that we could really find a new type of connection to them if we triangulated them through the history of the Kingdom of Congo, and in particular, the history of the Sangamento. So that particular type of political but also religious ceremony that sustained the political system of the Kingdom of Congo. And it was a festival that I had at the time just studied in my first book in some details. And as we came together, almost every presentation started with the image that was on the cover of the book, which is a representation of the Congadas in Brazil in the 19th century. And so we all joked, well, if we made a book from this conference, we know what would be on the cover. And so the idea of doing a book really kind of coalesced around that image and around the conversation. And then, as you know, it happens, some of the contributors to the conference ended up not participating in the book, and then new contributors came onto the project and contributed chapters to the book. So, you know, it was a conversation that started with the conference, but that continued beyond it. And I think I'm happy to see that it continues to be a point of conversation and inspiration for other work now that it is published as this edited volume.
Yeah, and that kind of makes me think too, your last points there. How do you see this, book standing out, I guess, in the existing scholarship? Like, what sets apart this edited volume compared to like other discussions of some of these, you know, festivals and whatnot?
Yeah, so I think what we wanted to do with the book as a group, and what I tried to realize as an editor, was several things. So first, we really wanted to make sure that the chapters would be good for teaching at the college level, and maybe even before that, they would be accessible even to a public that didn't have any background about a lot of those events that are each in a way very well studied, but often within subfields that are quite specialized in a way. So, for example, the congadas are very well studied, in particular in Brazil, in Portuguese language scholarship. But for those of us teaching in English-speaking countries, it is relatively harder to find material that is appropriate to share in an introductory class on this topic. So we wanted to, you know, keep an eye to this, to the classroom when we wrote the chapters. At the same time, these are all works of, real deep research and really putting into play a real engagement with the archive, either by bringing to the fore new documents or more often bringing to the fore new interpretations of documents that we thought we knew rather well before. And then the second aspect is really the many, I would say, transversalities that are in the book, that it's putting together festivals and types of religious cultures that have been studied in different corners of academia because they belong to different linguistic realms. They belong to South America or North America, and so wouldn't have been studied together. Also because they have been studied by different disciplines. So, some events have been studied by historians and others by ethnomusicologists or scholars of religion. And in the book, we wanted to bridge all of those divides with an analysis of these different types of events that had as a red thread their common, inspiration from West Central Africa, but then that wouldn't otherwise have been brought together necessarily under the same cover.
Yeah, that's really cool. It sounds like it's kind of a one-stop shop for kind of different case studies and perspectives that, as you were pointing out, haven't been brought together before. So I definitely think it's a useful tool for that. And that's really cool too, that you can use it sort of as a teaching tool as well. So I think that might be some different types of readers, that might be able to use this book in those different ways. And then, moving on more to the book's content as well, right? In the introduction, you state that this book, quote, reveals how enslaved and free Africans and later their descendants often used Christianity and Christian-derived celebrations as physical and mental spaces for autonomous cultural expression, social organization, and political empowerment, end quote. So can you talk about how these festivals came about, or festivities rather, especially thinking about, for instance, the background that you kind of lay out in the introduction?
Yes. So at the core of the project of bringing together this analysis is the common consideration of those festivals that I mentioned, or I should say those political ceremonies from the Kingdom of Congo. Those were ceremonies called sangamentos, which is a word that is a Portuguese version of a Kikongo word that is the language of the Kingdom of Congo, that means rejoicing or celebration, basically. And these sangamentos were a ways for the King of Congo and then the elite of the country to restage at key political and religious moments the foundation of the Kingdom of Congo as a Christian kingdom. So that these war dances, basically, so they are very spectacular dances that involved mock battles between the elite and then their followers, kind of in a hierarchical way. And so they restage first the foundation of the Kingdom of Congo in its deep origins from a foreign king who arrived into the location of the Kingdom of Congo, bringing about new technologies and a new philosophy. And then the second foundation of the Kingdom of Congo around 1500, when a newly Christian king who had learned to be Christian as the first generation of the Congo elite who grew up with Portuguese priests being present in the region. So this newly Christian king reconquers the kingdom in a way and turns it into a Christian kingdom. So this Sangamento is a festive summary of the reimagination of Christianity into Congo mythology that at the same times also turns Congo mythology into a Christian story of the advent of the new religion in the kingdom. And so why was that important? Was that that moment of celebration became key in affirming power and legitimacy for the kings of the Congo and then their elites in their provincial capitals, for example. And so that was a key moment in the political life of the Congo. And the Congo in West Central Africa was one of the principal regions from which men and women would be enslaved and then taken to the Americas from the beginning of the era of the slave trade, really to the end of it. And so that background of Christianity, or that background of the language of Christianity as a political tool and as a festive a manifestation of a political power, traveled with enslaved Africans to the Americas. And what we are looking at in the books is the different moments in which we can recognize that background in the Americas, in the coronation of the kings and queens of the Congo in Brazil, in a way that is, you know, made rather obvious even in the name of the festival, but also as different authors in the book discuss in North America, in Mexico, and then bringing us to a broader reflection that if we are considering the origin and trajectory of African-American religiosity, and by African-American, I mean it in a hemispheric sense, then we should look at Christianity itself and Catholicism and Congo Catholicism more specifically, as an African a source for that religiosity, instead of considering Christianity as the foil against which African-American religions would develop, or as the outside imposition that was willy-nilly co-opted and transformed by enslaved and Afro-descendant communities over time. So we can have a broader and a richer understanding of the nature and the texture of African American religions that take seriously Christianity as one of the sources and space for the development of African American religions.
Yeah, and that kind of sets us up for the first part of the book really well. You were kind of talking about this in terms of the sacramentos and, you know, the ritual battles that were brought over from the Congo Kingdom. So how do you see some of these same themes of, like, we were talking about, like, spaces for cultural expression, social organization and whatnot? How do you see that play out in some of the case studies presented in part one, for instance, like New Orleans, that starts off with?
Yes, no, I think in the first part, we have Jeroen de Wolf discussing a hypothesis that is proposing about the origins of the Mardi Gras Indians in New Orleans, in that kind of rich and deep background of West Central African Christianities, and also Miguel Valerio that is discussing early Afro-Christian performance in Mexico that involved a group of African characters that also he demonstrates would have had in their kind of cultural background, knowledge of the sangamentos in the Congo. And then Kevin Dawson, who is reading for us a naval battle on the coast of Brazil in the early 19th century, that is staging a fight, a mock fight between Moors and Christian, which is a type of event that is very common in Iberian kind of religious festivals or folk practices that has to do with the Reconquista in Iberia and the really kind of deeply held understanding of Muslims being the foils of Christian Europe. So the Moors standing for the Muslim and the Christians being the Spaniards, and then the defeat of the Muslims by the Spaniards being staged there. But is asking the question, well, what does it mean when you have Africans in Brazil staging that kind of battle? And looking at sangamentos, which were also already in the Congo, a restaging of sorts of the same ideas of the defeat of a non-Christian foil by a Christian kingdom, in this case, the Congo, then these strange and a little bit offbeat events start making a lot more sense in terms of what it may have meant and what the people from African origins or descent staging them were involved in creating by staging this very elaborate and very important events. So across the Americas and also across the centuries, because within that first part, we go from the 16th century to the 19th century, and we see echoes and parallels that, again, the triangulation through West Central Africa allows us to pinpoint, analyze, and then link together in a way that is, I think, broadening our understanding of African-American tradition at large.
Yeah, I think that was a really smart way to organize the book, because it seems to flow really well. And, it, you know, if you were teaching with this, for instance, you could, you know, absolutely see the way the introduction situates, you know, that first part. So I think that was really neat setup for that. And then, you know, going on to part two, continuing sort of like with these different types of festive traditions, right? You start getting into still looking at the Americas here, the way Black kings and their, quote, representation and performance, diplomacy, and the archive. So in these chapters in part two, how do we see these king figures complicated? How are they discussed here?
Yeah, so the part two is delving more deeply into the ways in which these festivals are being inscribed or, on the other hand, silenced within the shape of the colonial archive, specifically in Brazil and in the Portuguese Atlantic. So these festivals and the ways in which the people staging them are taking place and then are having a life of themselves within the political and social structure of colonial Brazil, in the case of Lisa Voigt's chapter, and then bridging the Atlantic from Brazil to Dahomey, so West Africa, in the case of Junia Ferreira Furtado's chapter, is becoming apparent there by asking about the ways in which those Afro-descendants who are staging these festivals are able to use the tools in terms of the representation tools. So Lisa Voigt is talking about the book that they published to celebrate some of the festivals, for example, so using alphabetic literacy and publishing and print culture at large to promote and also memorialize their festive traditions, appears in a certain shape in the archive, and that should be taken in conversation with the other types of memory or embodied memories that belong to the long repertoire of Afro-Brazilian traditions, and put together again gives us a richer understanding of, I think, colonial Brazil at large. And in fact, so important is this embodied memories of Afro-Brazilian traditions that we can follow them back in the experience of missionaries, actually not missionaries, ambassadors from Brazil who are tasked by the government to travel to Dahomey, so to West Africa. And they travel there with this deep embodied memories of Afro-Brazilian festivals and traditions that serve to them as the backgrounds against which they are able to approach festivals and rituals and ceremonies in West Africa. So that it gives us, again, a transversal view and a transversal reading of the connections and the ebbs and flows that link the different shores of the Atlantic world, and that, you know, gives textures to the Black Atlantic. So we don't have simply a story of a displacement and then diffusion of African traditions into the Americas or European traditions into the Americas, but you see back and forth and recreations that in some cases are going from Africa to Brazil and then back to Africa, and that the backgrounds through which these experiences are being recorded and perceived is one that is itself complicated. And as scholars, Voigt and Furtado are adding, you know, one more moment of you know, perceiving these traditions and analyzing them, that is inscribing itself in this long history of back and forth.
Yeah, and it definitely sounds like making sure that, you know, considering it's a lot about, you know, representation, ensuring that the agency of these peoples are brought to light, maybe more than what you were saying before about some other scholarship that has simply kind of presented Catholicism or Christian-derived things as more stagnant or more imposed. And I think that's a really powerful thing that comes through in the book, for sure. Going on to part three as well, and this is where you come in more directly as well. And you were talking about this too a little bit with part two about how, you know, looking at these different sources brings those through lines to life, right? So can you kind of talk about part three entitled Reconsidering Primary Sources here? Can you talk about your research process for your chapter in this part? And then can you talk a little bit about some of the key takeaways from Diane Stewart's chapter as well?
Yes, absolutely. So as I mentioned earlier, all of the participants in the project good spiritedly agreed that the lithograph by Rugendas would be the perfect cover for the book. And as the art historian in the group, I thought that, you know, it would be appropriate for me to look further at that image in light of what our projects was trying to realize collectively. And at the first level, so this image is representing one of those congadas, so one of those moments of the election of the king and queen of Congo in Brazil among a group of confraternal brothers and sisters within the orbit of the church. And it is a European image made by a European traveling artist who had spent some time in Brazil and kind of give us this view of the event that is, you know, very much about local color, and it is the picturesque. And but at the same time, it is based on first-hand observation. It is engaged with giving some specifics in terms of topography, for example. So you're able to recognize what church is including, and then, you know, some other, I guess, almost ethnographic details, right? Details that could be read in an ethnographic lens because we're able to, you know, to cross them with the region archive and as well as more recent festivals that are following still the same template. However, it is also an image that is very easily read as a, you know, carnivalesque scene, that it looks like a world upside down with Africans, which in this context of colonial Brazil are very easily and directly read as enslaved, or at least people at the bottom of the social hierarchy, that are, you know, wearing some elements of European royalty, so a crown here, a sash there, a powdered wig, etc., but that fits not comfortably and definitely not within the ideas of decorum of European royal pageantry. So you can think that, well, you know, it is just disenfranchised people seizing a moment of freedom or relative freedom in which they can put the world upside down. But in fact, if we bring this image into perspective with the background of the Sangamento, then we see that some of the key elements that are being shown in the image are actually not badly understood European regalia, but are very precisely reinvented with the means of a population that lived in poverty and at the bottom of the social hierarchies of colonial Brazil. So the reinventing the insignia of royalty from the Kingdom of Congo, such as the crown, for example, and then restaging the dances that are typical of the sangamentos. So that it demands from us a more subtle and also a more textured analysis than one that is saying, you know, a misunderstanding on the part of the Africans, or that is seeing the festival as kind of a moment of freedom that is given by the church and taken advantage of by the African populations as they can. But instead, we should see this image as a reflection of a set of organization, restaging of choreographies, dance steps, music. You have Central African musical instruments that are being represented there. Hierarchies. There is very clear, clearly different types of peoples being represented, and also insignia, the flags, the different elements that are being worn that echo a very specifically the background of West Central Africa. So that what we have is a document that we are at risk of misreading if we don't take into account that deep transatlantic background. And Diane Stewart's chapter is giving another and also a very poignant and I think very powerful example of how these kinds of misreadings have actually been so important in the historiography of, in her case, Afro-Caribbean religions, in that in the interpretation of Orisha tradition in Trinidad, there has been an understanding that on the one hand, you had the African side that was Yoruba that came with a new wave of African men and women that came from the Yoruba area in West Africa to Trinidad in the 19th century, that mixed as a syncretic process with European Christianity to create the Orisha religion that would be kind of a syncretic and syncretic tradition. But thinking about the deep background of Afro Catholicism and that came with West Central Africans who already were in Trinidad before the Yoruba population arrived, she's able to turn back to the archive and see the ways in which the ritual conversation that happened was also a conversation between Yoruba practitioners and Afro-Catholics that were already present in Trinidad. So that instead of a binary, oppression and resistance encounter between Africans with non-Christian religions and Europeans as holders of Christianity, you have a much more complex and interesting conversation that involved different religious traditions held by Africans and Afro descendants who came together and had this very rich ritual religious conversation that gave rise to the Orisha tradition in Trinidad.
Yeah, very cool. And I think the section and, you know, even with the other parts that you were discussing, it's kind of amazing how interdisciplinary the book is and all the different types of sources that, you know, you and, you know, Diane Stewart were drawing upon. And, you know, like you were talking about towards the beginning, using both archival and ethnographic stuff. So I think it's, even from a methodological standpoint, I think people will learn a lot in this too, in terms of how it, you know, looks at these different sources. And, you know, speaking of which too, there's kind of a different type of source that, you know, you all bring up in part four, orality, right? And, you know, the idea of the making of diasporic tradition. So can you talk about some of the conclusions in this more oral based last section, part four? What do we learn there?
Yeah, so in the fourth part, Michael Yanaga is bringing us to the present, right, in a way. I think a lot of the other chapters are in conversation between a historical moment and contemporary echoes. But in the discussion of domestic celebrations for Catholic saints, really in very different locations of the Afro-diasporic space, Yanaga is giving us a glimpse at what that kind of new understanding or renewed, right, understanding of the Christian dimension of African-American religiosity can do in our approaches and interpretation of contemporary Afro-diasporic religious traditions, such as those moments of ceremonies and domestic devotion to particular saints in altars that find themselves within homes, and where you see different groups coming together and bringing their songs and their prayers in what we discover by and large to be related and probably Central African inspired types of ceremonies. So that it kind of brings everything together for me, because it really shows how, you know, that deep engagement with the past can help us really bring new light to even very contemporary practices. And it can show us ways in which, you know, we've cut up the Americas by language and by different imperial traditions. Also, we've cut it up by the divide of Catholicism versus Protestantism. But there are still really deep lines that run through, such as the Central African heritage, for example. And if we think about it, you know, the enslaved men and women that came from Central Africa, or really any regions from the Americas, ended up populating the American continents, you know, from north to south. So, you know, if we, even if we speak about Latin America and English-speaking America, there is something really powerful in thinking about the Congo America or the Central African America that also exists there and that is still present and is still a structuring part of our, you know, societies and our religious traditions, be it in North America or in South America. So I really was grateful for this kind of concluding chapter of the book, because for me it is bringing it to our own moment and showing how we can, you know, rethink our approaches to our own practices.
Yeah, and that got me thinking too, again, like you said, it kind of brings us forward in time. But, you know, think you said something at the beginning about how you hope to see, or you're starting to see other studies, you know, maybe building on this book. So let me ask you this kind of with your expertise, where do you see or hope to see studies on Congo-derived, or in other words, these Afro-Catholic festive traditions? Where do you see the future of this study going? Where do you see this book, you know, pushing those studies further, if that makes sense?
Yes, no, absolutely. I think, you know, I'm hoping that there is a lot of methods that are demonstrated in this book or showcased in the book that can then be taken to different places. And also that there are kind of hints, little pieces of information, little moments where you have several items that come together that the different authors read as the key to interpreting a certain type of event as maybe Central African inspired, that then can be brought to the analysis of different areas and different moments that may not have been talked about in the book. I'm thinking about things like, you know, the election of a leader within an African or Afro-descendant group in a particular place in the Americas that would involve, you know, some of the practices that we described here that all of a sudden would go from kind of obscure or, you know, difficult to interpret to really clearly related to some of those traditions. So there are definitely things like elections in Albany, New York in the 19th century that I think could also be related to the West Central African traditions that are awaiting to be understood in this way. And then I think at the broader level, there is a way in which there's been a lot of emphasis on the Yoruba dimension of Afro-diasporic religions in the Americas that are absolutely, you know, have been absolutely crucial in understanding those religious traditions, but also that have left relatively little space for looking at the Central African aspect of things. And partly it was because the Central African aspect of things tended to be very much imbricated with Christianity, as we've been talking about, so less recognizable to some extent. And with some of the hints and then some of the methods that we have brought together in the book, I'm hoping that it will be easier to, you know, pay closer attention to the Central African aspect of things, as well as the Yoruba side, so that it will renew our conversation on African-American religion in that regard.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And I'll have to keep an eye out on where things go following the book. And speaking of where things go, I want to ask you, Dr. Framon, what other projects are you working on these days?
Yes, thank you. Well, I am working on a range of projects, partly because of the pandemic. So I've found myself exploring different areas. But I just finished a book that is, in a way, following some of the methodological questions that are in part in the book, having to do with challenging the limits, or I should say the perimeter of the European archive, visual archive about non-European places and locals and tradition, by thinking seriously about the conditions under which European images of European forms made for Europeans are being created. By thinking seriously about these conditions, to pay attention to the encounters that were at the basis of his images. So encounters between Europeans and the people that they called the others, that I think were really important in the shape that this image took. And so if we take seriously these conditions, then I argue that we should see that encounter as one of the authors of those images. And so that's something that we could apply to the Rugendas image, that even though it's an image made by a European artist for European viewers, but about Afro-Brazilian festival makers, I think the conditions of the encounter between Rugendas and that festive moment is also part of the authorship of the image. And as such, the festival goers are also in part the authors of that image.
That sounds really interesting, and I'll look forward to checking that out. I'm excited. But thank you so much, Dr. Froman, for joining us today. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and listeners, just as a reminder, this was an interview with Dr. Cecile Froman, editor of Afro-Catholic Festivals in the Americas, Performance, Representation, and the Making of Black Atlantic Tradition, published by Penn State University Press in 2019, and released in paperback this May of 2021. This is Emily Allen, and I'll catch you next time here on the New Books Network.